succession number 26756, real one.
So Jeffrey Chandler, real one. Okay, can we start right at the beginning?
Mm-hmm.
And can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born on the 15th of November, 1922, in 4 Downshire Hill, Hampstead, London.
And what were your family circumstances at that time?
My father was a doctor, and our family circumstances, I suppose, were a relatively comfortable middle class, if that is what you mean by the question.
Yes. Your father, I understand, had some interesting First World War experiences. Would that be correct?
He did indeed. He was a doctor in the front line. He was medical officer or regimental doctor to the 2nd Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, and he wrote diaries, which some of which were published, which you have. He then became a very distinguished chest physician, but died of cancer at the age of 57.
Did he ever talk about his time in the...
No, very, very, very rarely, and I think it's extraordinary. I've been recently reading his letters and extracting those bits about the war, and it is incredible that anyone survived, because he was in the front line, in the trenches, at the casualty clearing stations for quite a time. And he very, very rarely talked about this in the very many letters he wrote to his future wife, my mother. And there are just very few extracts. One or two of them are so dramatic. He says this was hell. He has to return to hell. But very little reference in the letters. And he never spoke about it at all to us as children, except we were brought up very much with the feeling that war was almost the ultimate evil. It obviously was a terrible experience for those who went through it. I also remember, because he died in 42, but he was practicing in London during the bombing of London, and he said that bombing was more frightening even than German shelling, because you never knew where it was coming from. Shells, you knew where they were coming from in the First World War. But he didn't talk about it, and I think it's characteristic of people in the First World War, not this is irrelevant to your subject, that because no one could actually understand how frightful the trenches were, and therefore they simply didn't talk about it.
And where did you go to school?
I went to a prep school in Hampstead. I went to an independent school or public school at Sherburn in Dorset, where I suppose I was comparatively successful as head of house, captain of tennis, member of an unbeaten rugby 15. But it was a somewhat philistine school where rugby was worshipped more probably than academic subjects. I was taught no formal science, but I suppose I have to say it did me good. And I don't know what more to say about it.
Did you receive any OTC training?
Yes, indeed. We had the OTC. We had putties, which were absolutely frightful to wind, because you always had to get them to a precise place on your leg. I don't remember much about it, except when we had gas mask practice, I used to have to take my glasses off, and I'd be led stumbling blindly about, led by somebody else's hand. So I felt if there ever a gas attack in real wartime, I wouldn't be much good. And if I kept my glasses on, they steamed up, all the gas masks leaked.
Where were you at the outbreak of war? Were you still at school?
I was at school, yes.
And how did you feel at that point, that September?
I remember this very day. Again, I remember my father's dismay. I mean, the 3rd of September, 1939, 11 o'clock. I mean, we were down here, which was then my parents' country cottage. And, of course, the air raid siren went. And we had an air raid shelter, which my father would never have built, but a grateful patient insisted on building for him. So we had an Anderson air raid shelter in the garden. And the air raid siren went, and we sort of waited, should we retreat to this place? But then, of course, the all clear went. So I do remember very, very distinctly. I can see in my mind's eye precisely where we were. And I think I can feel today. My father, I think, unlike so many people, was not prepared to believe that Munich was the inevitable precursor of war, because he felt it was such a terrible thing. He also expected that no one who became a subaltern, a second lieutenant, which one was presumed to become if one joined the army, would survive, because so many people of that rank had been killed in the First World War.
How long were you at school for after that? Was it?
I suppose 40 was my last year. Was it 41? Then I had a year at Cambridge and then was called up.
What was Cambridge like in those in that early part of the war? To be living and studying?
I'm ashamed to say that going to Cambridge after school was like having the lid taken off a pressure cooker. And the sheer joy of talking to people and talking all day and all night was such. I was a very immature youth. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I think I was immature. And all I really remember is talking all day and all night. Oh, God. I'm sure at the bottom of my mind also was, you know, one ought to be doing something else. But my father had cancer, and it was mortal cancer. And therefore, I think, again, I did not volunteer. I waited to be called up because I wanted to be available at home.
And so you were enlisted after a year, or you called up after a year?
Look at my notes. Because I couldn't remember. I was called up in July 42. So I went to Cambridge in July 41, I suppose, September 41. So I was at school up to 41, yes. And then went into the 60th in 42. I mean, incidentally, the 60th is interesting, because the 60th came round recruiting in school, so that when one did go into the army, they thought, probably erroneously, they were getting good people. So, I mean, I had, as it were, chosen my regiment before being called up. And then I was called up as a rifleman into the ranks of the 60th in July 42.
How did you find your time in the ranks and the training that you were given there?
Oh, wonderful. You were a total lack of responsibility. And also, it was great fun. There were many people from Oxford and Cambridge at times, terribly snobby, but they were intellectually stimulating because a lot of people are around. And I could strip and reassemble a Bren gun almost blindfold, quicker than most people. One learned to shoot, one learned skills, which I've now totally forgotten. I also used to get on right quite... We had a very typical army sergeant, I mean, brutal, foul-mouthed, but somehow he didn't mind my curious accent, which I hated myself, or timbre of voice. And he used to ask me to give the odd lecture, so I would to the platoon and everyone else is about. So I remember giving a lecture on Churchill, Oscar Wilde, T.E. Lawrence, all sorts of people. Then you'd suddenly say, "Officer, come in, Chandler." And I'd go straight into, you know, fires one or two rounds and stops again of the Bren gun drill. And after the officer had wandered off, I'd return. And somehow this chap, you know, typical foul-mouthed army sergeant, we got on rather well. But at times it was, I have to say, it was fun.
And in October 1942, I think, you went to Octu.
That is correct. That was it. That's correct. We moved up to York, where the Octu was, because the 60th moved when the Americans came in. The 60th moved from Winchester to York, and I went to Octu. Which, again, you know, was physically and mentally stimulating.
Did you find any of the OTC training that you'd had at school of use at all? I mean, did it give you any background knowledge that proved useful?
I'm ashamed to say I can't remember. This isn't much help. I think, well, you know, I knew one's left foot from one's right foot. I suppose one had some sense of military discipline. But otherwise, I frankly don't remember.
And do you remember anything specific about the training, the instruction that you were given on the during the officer training?
Though I say it myself, I did rather well. I passed third out of a group of 60 people. But I wasn't allowed to take the passing out parade of one of the people because my voice wouldn't carry. So I remember being congratulated by enormous surprise by the general who was supervising the passing out parade, who must have been the commanding officer of the 60th. Do I remember anything about it? I remember having to lie... No, I mean, odd things. You know, lying down on concertina wire with people walking over your back as a way of getting over concertina wire, which I don't recommend, but it does work. And nowadays, you couldn't do it with razor wire. Otherwise, I was fitter than I've ever been in my life, I think. I think what one learnt, you could almost take anything if you were commanding people. If you had a march, of which you were in charge of, say, 30 people a platoon, and you were in charge, you would actually endure however tough it was. If you were simply a member of the ranks, it was much tougher. Which apparently is probably a truism anyhow. Otherwise, I didn't remember very much about it, except again, they were an interesting bunch of people. I used to embarrass the head of the British Civil Service, Ian Bancroft, who became Lord Bancroft, by saying, when I used to sleep with a booted knight, because Ian, being a B and I a C, we slept next to each other in the same barrack room. and there were other people. There was an Oxford composer called John Veal. There were a lot of interesting people. And I mean, the interesting thing about the 60th, it was a very interesting regiment. The Artists' Rifles was an affiliated regiment, so we got writers and cartoonists and artists who became part of the regular battalions. So it was a stimulating regiment to be in.
And from after you were commissioned, you returned, well, you posted to a 1st Motor Training Battalion.
That's correct. I mean, this was still training. This was in York, and I then did a signals course at Catterick. But again, I learnt a skill. I could read and receive Morse at 15 words a minute, and now I cannot even remember the alphabet.
How did you come to join PWE?
Jolly good question. I was trying to think of the answer to this if the question got asked. The 60th battalions were being disbanded for a reason I cannot remember, and officers were being posted from the 60th to other regiments. I wanted to stay in the regiment, and the way to do it was to try and get some more eccentric form of operation. So I volunteered for the Phantoms, who were, I forget what they were. They were reconnaissance troops riding in scout cars in front of regular troops. And then a friend of mine had gone out to political warfare and was hoping to get into SOE in Greece. So I thought this was a jolly good thing to try and do. So I went and bought a Greek dictionary. Modern Greek dictionary. I had done some ancient Greek, in fact, I had done ancient Greek at school, and read it for 1 year at Cambridge. And through a mechanism I simply do not remember, even if I knew, I did go out to political warfare in Cairo, and eventually got to Greece, which is where I wanted to get to.
How did you travel out to Cairo?
By ship, a P&O ship, whose name was, I kept quite a lot of diary, what was it called? Sorry to waste your tape. Yeah, we went from, yes, all right, the P&O Strathaven, which is now called HM Transport F10, and this was from Greenock. So we went from Greenock to Portside, and from Portside to Cairo by train.
Do you remember much of the sea journey?
Yes, I remember the Bay of Biscay. I was not seasick. The poor old people, I mean, it was a troop ship, absolutely packed. And, I mean, people were terribly sick. You went to the lower decks and you read it. It was pretty nasty. I mean, people were being sick all over the place. I don't remember an awful lot about it. There was an ENSA group on board. So there were some very good musicians. There was also Harry Roy and his band. But since I like classical music, I tended to listen to the cellists and the others more than Harry Roy. There was also, otherwise I don't remember an awful lot about it, except silly details like what saltwater soap is like and how inadequate it is. But we were fed remarkably. I mean, compared to this country, under rationing and so on, we had a naffy on the ship from which you could get absolutely anything.
What sort of duties did you have on ship?
Again, I don't recall. I don't think that we did have many duties. None that I can remember. Life of gross irresponsibility, clearly.
So you arrived in Cairo in December 1943.
That is correct.
And from there, what happened to you then?
There I did a political warfare, did a training course, which I think, I must remember, went on to March 44. and I think I felt guilty at being there and not in Greece operationally. So we did training, we got a lot of education about political warfare, about the situation in the Balkans, which is how I know about Tosks and Gags and other awkward people. And then I joined the Greek section in Cairo and was responsible for some of the material I'd given you.
During the training, were you aware of what sort of work you'd be, what countries you'd be working into?
Well, in that my objective was always to go to Greece, and I was learning Greek, and I stayed with a Greek family in Cairo in order to learn the language. I think the answer is yes.
And who was teaching you during the training?
Distinguished Balkan figures, whose names I cannot remember now. Well, there were people like, that's not quite true. David Wallace, who was the Foreign Office emissary to the occupation, was killed in Ypres. He and I knew, of course, again, he was in the 60th. He lectured Kenneth Johnston, the head of the British Council, or to be the head of the British Council in Greece, lectured, and a number of figures whose name I forget now. And they were experts on the Balkans.
You mentioned that you stayed in Cairo with a Greek family. What was Cairo like to live in during that period?
There were two Cairos. There was sort of central Cairo where you could wander about quite freely. There was Cairo, poor Cairo, where you would be, which was virtually out of bounds. Well, I think it was probably actually out of bounds, and where you would be at some risk if you went. But it was a very civilized place. I've just been reading Edward Said's autobiography called Out of Place, and he was a younger man, but it's fascinating. He is describing Cairo at a time when I was there. He described music, which I actually heard at the time. So he is talking about places which I knew. It was a very, in many ways, this was after Alamein, so it felt safe. And it was a civilized, sophisticated place. But again, I think had I been a more sophisticated person of my age, I suppose I was only 21 then, I think I could have got more out of it. You know, one could visit the pyramids and the Valley of the Kings and so on. But again, I think all the time I had a sense I ought to be doing something which was operational. So I had a sense of impatience and dissatisfaction.
So in March 1944, you became second in command of the PWE.
Greek section, that's correct.
And where in Cairo did you work?
Can't remember.
And what kind of work did you do?
Oh, I mean, basically, writing and editing material to go into Greece. There were some extraordinary characters there. There was Russell Page, the great gardener designer, who was in charge. There was the editor of the Daily Express, whose name I forget, but a great Prussian chap with a great balding head. And these were real professionals, or Russell, the editor was. And that's basically what I did.
How closely did you work with officers returning from the field? Did you see anything of them at all as they came back from Greece?
Yes, but I wasn't, but that, they weren't, there wasn't a real, up to a point is the answer.
Similarly, how closely did you work with SOE in Cairo?
I didn't really work closely until I was actually going into Greece and was briefed by SOE.
How aware were you of operations in the field and life in the field during that period?
I think broadly aware. And there was a great difference. I mean, in Cairo still tended to take the view that people in the field had gone bush and what they said couldn't be relied upon, which was untrue, and therefore there was always a contrast to people coming back and saying, and the Foreign Office, of course, was still supporting the king and the return of the king at a time, by which time it was still totally, it was inappropriate. So I think adequately informed.
Did everyone in the PWE office, to your knowledge, feel the same way about operations and news that was coming back? Did they interpret the news the same way?
It wasn't our job to interpret the news. I suspect the answer is A, it was not their job, and B, I think I have to say I don't know. We operated according to directives, and this is quite important. There were directives about the propaganda which would go out to the occupied countries. And I mean, some of them, and I wish I could find my notes, but I can't. I mean, some of them were absolutely bizarre. I think there was one directive: do not encourage spring sowing, but do not actively discourage it. So what the bloody hell you do with a directive like that, I don't know. And these were supposed, and I suppose what we were doing in information to the occupied territory, countries, was operating within these broad directives, which weren't consistent across a number of countries. Pretty useless answers, all these, I'm afraid.
How did you come to join SOE from PWE?
Oh, of course, I mean, it's the moment of arrival in Egypt. I pressed again and again and again to get into Greece. And eventually, my prayers or pleadings or importunacy was answered. And I went on a parachute and sabotage course and then went in.
Where did you do that special training?
That was in Italy.
And can you what are your impressions of that? Can you recall, what would you recall of that?
Oh, I recall a lot. I mean, a most magnificently short and effective parachute course, which I sent you an extract from my diary about, run by a Polish captain, whose name I temporarily forget, who was training a couple of Englishmen, Americans from the Office of Strategic Services, Italian partisans, and Popsky's private army people from. And he taught us in alternatively Italian and English impeccably. And one had total confidence. We did our first drop on the second day and our final drop on the fourth day. And the object was just to get us from A to B. We weren't properly trained parachutists. But it was a very effective course in which one had total confidence.
And you received sabotage training? And
sabotage training was, yes. That was, we were trained how to blow up railway lines with plastic explosive. I was taught to drive a steam engine and how to sabotage it. And the theory was you got into a marshalling yard, you turned the turntable the wrong way round, you got then into a steam engine, you drove it into the turntable. This is a skill I still haven't exercised, I still look forward to using. And we were taught to use enemy weapons and so on. And I still dream of picking up weapons and not having a clue how to fire them. No, I haven't dreamt of that for some time, but I used to. So generally, it was very simple sabotage training, basically using plastic explosive. There were all sorts of little devices, like Nuldang, which was an explosive, what you call them, caltrops, these many-sided spikes you put on the roads, and so on. Kick it.
So Jeffrey Chandler, Reel 2. Sorry,
On the parachute course,
yeah.
We were guarded by Yugoslav